I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's a college football fight song Friday, so since Justin Buechler is going to be here, joins us now, Associate Professor of Political Science at Case Western Reserve University. Professor, we thought we'd start out with Fight On from the Case Western Reserve University band. How about that?
All right. Well, there's a political fight on right now, so that's the appropriate song, I guess.
There you go. Let's talk about the political fight that's happening. Anything new?
Pretty much polls. I mean, we're watching the polls, and we're watching for any movement in the polls, and it's tight. This is basically the closest presidential election since 2000, and that's sort of where it stands.
So I remember when I first started doing this years and years and years ago, I remember talking to people about presidential campaigns and how important it was, even with all the national advertising and everything else, to actually get people on a bus, get them to vote, give them rides to the polls, et cetera. Is that where we are at this point?
That's a big part of it, and the important thing to understand about that aspect of the campaign is that because both sides are doing it in any given campaign, it's sort of like a tug of war, and each side's efforts sort of cancel each other out to some degree. But both parties, both campaigns have to do it, because if one side gives up, that gives the other side the advantage. But they're kind of canceling each other out in terms of those kinds of campaign efforts. And it sort of reverts to the underlying fundamentals, which are still pretty close at the national level.
And those underlying fundamentals are the party loyalty or personality or what?
So party loyalty is a big part of it. I mean, remember that this is kind of a 50-50 country. We have the country relatively evenly split between Democrats and Republicans. We have an economy which is kind of complicated because we have positive GDP growth, but we also have some economic pessimism. We also have this weird situation where we have an outgoing Democratic president whose popularity numbers are not very good. And we have all of those factors feeding into a situation which is just fundamentally very close.
Can you remember, and I'm probably answering my own question here, but you got a former president running against an incumbent vice president where the incumbent president chose not to run. This is new territory.
Well, it's new territory in some sense. I mean, any one aspect of this particular campaign has at least some precedent. We've seen a former president run before, although it's been a really long time since that's happened. We have seen a president step down and have the vice president step in. I mean, 1968 has some parallels in this particular campaign. So we've seen some elements. It's just that basically every weird aspect of a presidential campaign is sort of combined into 2024. So, for example, in 1968, we had Lyndon Johnson step down. Then the Democrats nominated Hubert Humphrey after the campaign played out. Eugene McCarthy won the primaries. The primaries didn't really matter, so we had that complicated business in 1968 where the Democrats nominated the vice president. We had a former vice president who had run for office, who had run for the presidency in 1960 and then lost. So, I mean, we've had these elements before. It's just that everything all at once is sort of playing out together in 2024.
I see so many things on social media. You know, one of them was, attacking the, let me get this straight now, attacking the Trump campaign for criticizing Kamala Harris as vice president and what she got accomplished, asking what did Mike Pence get accomplished during his 4 years as vice president. And I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican, one thing that confuses me about this is that, and in a way, I guess it's smart by former President Trump to attach Kamala Harris to the Biden presidency when, in fact, the vice president doesn't have a whole lot to do with policy, or do they?
Mostly vice presidents do very little. The only time that the vice president does anything is if the president delegates tasks. So, for example, during the George W. Bush administration, George W. Bush delegated several tasks to Dick Cheney. But mostly vice presidents do very little unless powers are delegated specifically to the vice president. Kamala Harris has not had a lot of tasks delegated to her. There is the question of exactly how much authority was delegated to her regarding the border. But generally speaking, vice presidents don't do much.
So I guess I'm wondering how you can say that Kamala Harris, I'm not campaigning for, I'm not campaigning against anybody, but it seems like the argument would collapse on itself if you say that nobody knows who she is, but yet she hasn't accomplished anything, because if she was in control of the White House or running policy, we would have known. She wouldn't be unknown, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, in some sense, it's a little unfair because she hasn't really been in charge of much of anything for the last 4 years. But at the same time, she has been a part of the Biden administration, and the differences between her positions and the Biden positions are relatively minimal. So the basic thing to understand is that presidents and presidential candidates, they're all part of a party, and the parties are relatively unified. So if you're looking for a heuristic to understand a presidential candidate, party is a pretty good heuristic. So if you understand the outgoing president, you pretty well understand the sitting vice president.
Right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We're talking to Justin Buechler, our friend, associate professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University. Less than 2 weeks until election, early voting underway here in Louisiana as well, and we encourage you to vote early if you can. If not, make sure you vote on Election Day. We'll talk about the congressional races as well when we come back, which is an extremely important part of this, the entire House of Representatives, a third of the Senate up, as is the case every 2 years, and I don't know that that's getting a lot of attention. But it's going to have a lot to do with the way the government operates in the next 4 years. 620 Traffic Now, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with Justin Buechler, associate professor of political science at Case Western Reserve University. I'm just laughing at some of the texts that are coming in. People taking this race very personally, Professor.
That's true. This is a very polarized country. People have some pretty strong feelings about both parties, both candidates. And this is a pretty intense race.
Campaigns are different than governing, though, and the government is not just comprised of the Oval Office. Of course, they got Capitol Hill and the Senate and the House. What are the races around the country looking like? And I know you guys got a big one going on there in Ohio. Tell me about that, and also about the likelihood of either the Senate or the House flipping.
So, here in Ohio, we have a very close Senate race. Sherrod Brown is a relatively far-left incumbent senator in a state that has been shifting more towards the Republican Party. So this is a pretty tight race. Generally speaking, incumbents win. But given that Ohio has been shifting more towards the Republicans, this is a pretty tight race. And the polls are very close right now. So I'm looking at the polling average right now. Real Clear Politics has Brown up by an average of just 1 point, which is razor thin. And if you're looking at the Senate overall, the map this year is very favorable to the Republicans. So if you remember how Senate elections work, only a third of the Senate is up in any given election cycle, which means that just random chance can favor one party or the other, depending on which seats are up. And this year, the map is very favorable to the Republicans. So Sherrod Brown is up, and just the general map leans very heavily towards the Republicans.
That's in Ohio.
I'm talking about the overall map.
Oh, okay.
Ohio, right now it looks like Ohio is basically a toss-up. We have no idea what's going to happen in Ohio. Ohio is a toss-up. But the Senate overall, because of the particular array of seats that are up, it probably goes Republican. So if you just sort of add up all of these seats that are either not up at all or that are leaning Republican, Republicans probably get to 51, just not even counting who is vice president and then might cast a tie-breaking vote. Republicans probably get to 51. So, for example, John Tester in Montana is probably going to lose, so that seat flips. So if you look at all of the seats that Republicans can hold and then they flip John Tester's seat in Montana, they probably get to 51. The House is a little bit different because what usually happens with the House of Representatives in a presidential election is whichever party wins the White House will tend to pick up seats in the House of Representatives. And in the House of Representatives right now, it is a razor-thin margin. The Republicans just have the barest majority possible. So if the Democrats win the White House, Kamala Harris wins, then the Democrats pick up seats. And if they pick up any seats, then the House of Representatives will flip. If Donald Trump wins, then the Republicans maintain a majority in the House of Representatives in all likelihood.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, please.
Yeah, so basically, if Harris wins, the likeliest outcome is Harris, a Democratic majority in the House and Republican Senate. If Trump wins, then it's probably unified Republican government.
Does anybody have coattails either way?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about, is the House is where you're probably going to see coattails. So if whichever party wins the White House, the coattails will give that party the House of Representatives. That's what I mean.
That's what I thought you were trying to say. I just wanted to clear it up. Thank you, sir. Professor, appreciate your time. Justin Buechler, Associate Professor of Political Science, Case Western Reserve University. 6:30, time for WWL First News. 6:42, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Maureen Molak, co-founder of Parents SOS and David's Legacy Foundation, to talk about the Kids Online Safety Act. Good morning, Maureen. How are you?
Hi, good morning, Tommy. Doing well, thank you.
Maureen, I'm a parent, and I just got to tell you, I am so sorry for your loss, and I can't even begin to comprehend the pain you must feel. I don't know how parents that have lost children deal with it. They're in my prayers every night, as will you be, because for the rest of my life, because I can't even begin to comprehend it. I'm sorry for your loss.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Tell me what happened with David, if you would, please, and then we'll talk about the act.
Sure. 8 years ago, I lost my son, David. He was 16 years old at the time, to suicide. His death followed a year-long battle with social media and online gaming addiction, as well as there at the latter part of his life, months of intense and threatening cyberbullying that left him feeling helpless and hopeless. And you know, at the time, even though we were getting him the mental health supports that he needed, it wasn't enough.
Do you know where the bullying was coming from?
Yeah, it was from a group of students at his school, but it actually ended up spreading on social media. And it was just the sheer magnitude of it that was so damaging, even to the point to where we had to move schools to try to get him away from his perpetrators. But what we didn't understand at the time is that cyberbullying doesn't require geographic proximity, mm-hmm. and it ended up following him to his new school.
Mm. Did you have any idea how bad it was when this was happening, Maureen?
You know, at the latter stages of it, yes. Early on, he, as most kids, think that they can deal with it on their own. And, you know, there's a lot of shame and embarrassment around it. But by the time that we found out about the cyberbullying, he was already so far spiraling down. And it was just like the final match on a huge bonfire that exploded in our home.
Do you have any idea why these idiots would choose to pick on your son? Why is it a herd mentality? Is it a pack thing? And the people that did this, were they ever held responsible?
Yeah, that's what we call it, a cyber mob. And, you know, it started over jealousy over a girl. And then, you know, they started attacking his mental health as well as his looks and just his entire persona. And because he had this, you know, addiction to social media and online gaming, he had this persona that who he thought he was online. And when the cyberbullying started, it just really cut to his core, and, you know, he just could not handle it. The latter part of your question, there was some accountability at the school level for some of the perpetrators. But as far as the social media impact of that, you know, a lot of the students who saw it occurring were reporting it to the platform, and nothing was being done.
Let's talk about the Kids Online Safety Act and what perhaps that would do to prevent something like this in the future.
Sure. Yeah. The Online Safety Act, the Kids Online Safety Act, we've been advocating for that for over 2.5 years. It just recently passed the Senate with a landslide vote of 91-3, basically something unheard of in this Congress. And, you know, it's now in the House, and we're calling on Speaker Johnson and Majority Leader Scalise to help us get this over the finish line by the end of this year. And, you know, I've been advocating with many other survivor parents, as well as parents out there whose children who have been harmed by social media harms thankfully their kids are still here with us. And so we represent millions of American families who are calling on Republican leadership in the House to get this done this year.
What's in the bill, Maureen?
So the heart of the bill is the duty of care, the responsibility of the social media platforms to take reasonable efforts to design and operate their platforms where they prevent and mitigate, you know, a very narrow list of well-defined harms. Like the addiction-like behaviors that my son suffered from, promotion of illegal substances, sexual exploitation, and cyberbullying are just a few of the harms that are well-defined in the bill. There's also some safety by default, which would mean that a parent would not have to go through a maze of clicks and try to figure out how each one of these platforms works so that they can protect their kids automatically. It would default to the most highest protective settings, which is really, really important. It's what we hear from parents. It's playing whack-a-mole as they're trying to figure out how to navigate through all these different platforms. There's also some transparency and independent audit requirements in the bill.
I'm going to get back to that in a second, but what interests me, Maureen, when you said that as a parent, is that who your son was kind of got, I guess, blended with the online persona, and then as a result, I guess from his mental health standpoint, the two kind of got blurred as far as who he really was and the online persona. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's exactly right. You know, because of the addiction that he had to social media, you know, it created, you know, a situation where he was anxious and depressed because he knew there was something wrong with his behavior, but he could not control himself. So it had a grip on him that was just, it was so damaging. And he had this idea of who he was through these, you know, through online gaming and watching these professional gamers that were continuously showing up in his feed, and the reward system, the gambling-like behaviors and the rewards that he would receive. So you can imagine that when the cyberbullying occurred, it completely diminished any type of idea of who he thought he was online, and that was what was so difficult for him to be able to understand.
It seems like almost, and I'm not trying to be melodramatic here, but it almost is as though he got sucked online and then almost ceased to exist as the real person that he was. Accurate?
Yep, that's exactly right, Tommy.
Wow. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. I want to talk more about Parents SOS Safe Online Spaces, about the support you got from this from both John Kennedy and Senator Bill Cassidy, and about the hopes, what's going on with Mike Johnson. You got some powerful friends here in the House of Representatives, with the Speaker of the House, with the Majority Leader, and you would think that they'd be able to bring this up. And if you got 91-3, if it got out of the Senate 91-3, you would think there would be immense bipartisan support for this. And I would ask, what, if anything, what's holding it up in the House other than big tech and money? We're talking to Maureen Molak, co-founder of Parents SOS and David's Legacy Foundation. She lost her son to cyberbullying, suicide. And you parents, if you have any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. I do want to address it from the standpoint when we come back of tips for parents, things they can watch for until something like this gets happened or after until this bill gets passed. 650 traffic now, WWL. 655, 5 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Maureen Molak, co-founder of Parents SOS and David's Legacy Foundation. She lost her son by suicide in 2016 due to cyberbullying, and I can't, you know, again, Maureen, just as a parent, I could understand maybe the pain and coping with something, if a disease or cancer or something like that. Not that I'm trying to mitigate any of that, but to think that this senseless bullying, cyber bullying, that just out of meanness and spite and no other reason than that. God bless y'all. Tell me about Parents SOS.
Oh, yeah, sure. So Parents SOS is a group of parents, 20 of us, who have lost children to various online harms, like sexual exploitation, sextortion, pro-suicide content that was fed to a young girl. And also a young boy, and then, you know, a couple of our members have lost children to fentanyl overdoses that were the child bought the drug on social media platforms. And so, you know, we've all come together to represent the masses of American families who are asking for common sense safeguards and guardrails online for children, and coming together to support and advocate for the Kids Online Safety Act.
If you could, Maureen, can you talk to parents that are listening right now that have teenagers that maybe don't understand what could be happening with their kids online and what they can look out for and things they need to pay attention to?
Sure. You know, I think the most important thing to recognize is that the conversations that we have in our homes are so valuable. So if we can continue to talk about these harms and alert our children of what experiences that they may be having online that could lead to something dangerous, and also, you know, advocating at their school level for things like media literacy, digital citizenship, or phone-free schools. Those are all important aspects. But I want to be really clear that, you know, we can, as parents, we can do everything that we think to protect our kids online, but you can't protect them against something that you don't know exists out there. And until these platforms are actually required to design and operate their platforms with the highest safeguards in mind for children, we will never be able to keep our kids safe online. And it is the only industry out there that where we know that we have kids that are on these platforms. Over 90% of kids have smartphones. Until those platforms are actually required to be safe, parents will never be able to keep their kids safe enough.
Yeah, as we talk here, Maureen, I think about, you know, smoking back in the day, and you could smell it on a kid, or you could smell if they were smoking, and the tobacco industry did things to market it, tobacco to the kids and get them hooked. But this is vastly different. There's no scent, there's no smell, it flies beneath the radar. And the algorithms are just far beyond anything the tobacco industry could have imagined with market research. Talk about that, if you would.
Sure. So, I mean, you know, we have this business model where it's designed for the platforms to keep our kids engaged, right? So as soon as they can addict them at a young age, they will have a user on their platform for life. So if we kind of look at how it's the business model is designed, So they want to keep our kids engaged. And so in David's situation, his addiction to social media and online gaming was at the core of what he experienced. So the more that our kids are engaged online, the higher their chances of coming up against an additional harm. So if we can get to the core of the addiction of the social media, then we can be able to address some of these other harms. But the social media platforms right now have no incentive to do that. And until Congress actually requires them to do that, we're not going to see any meaningful changes.
A website real quick where people can go if they want to get involved?
ParentsSOS.org.
ParentsSOS.org. Thank you, Maureen. Again, I'm so sorry for your loss. Maureen Molak, co-founder of Parents SOS, David's Legacy Foundation. We're going to come back, talk to Jeff Palermo about the LSU game.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
It is 7:15. It's going to be warm and sunny throughout the weekend and dry like it has been. No change there, but a big game. Tim and I were talking about this. Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network news director. This is probably the big game of the weekend in college football with the highest-ranked opponents taking on each other. And then Texas A&M LSU.
Yeah, this is the biggest game of the weekend, Tommy. Good morning.
Good morning.
And who would have thought at the beginning of the season that these two teams, when they would meet here in late October, it would be the marquee game, especially considering what happened in the season opener. I mean, Texas A&M didn't look very good, losing at home to Notre Dame, and we all know what happened with LSU losing to USC.
Tim brought up, we were talking about it's a college football fight song Friday here. I'm playing fight songs, and I played the Navy fight song because Navy and Army both in the top 25. And I was, Tim was talking about them playing Notre Dame earlier in the day, Navy playing Notre Dame. And the only thing I'm concerned with the Notre Dame-Navy game is if Navy wins, I might be just laughing too much to enjoy the LSU game.
Why would you be laughing too much?
Because Notre Dame lost to Navy, that's all. And I'm not a big Notre Dame fan, but that's just me, you know. Let's talk about the Texas A&M Aggies. What do they bring to the field?
Well, they got a very strong running attack, led by Le'Veon Moss, who played his high school football right here in Baton Rouge. He was a star at Estruma, who ended up actually, he originally committed to Alabama and now obviously went and signed with Texas A&M. And he's second in the SEC in rushing, and they lean on him quite a bit. Connor Wegman is their starting quarterback. Wegman is a guy that was highly recruited out of the state of Texas. He just hasn't really put it together just yet, Tommy. I mean, I think that's the thing with him. He's had some injuries. He had a foot injury that limited him to just four games last year. He had a shoulder injury this year, forced him to miss three games. And so they've been kind of waiting over there in Texas A&M for his coming out party. He had a good performance against Missouri, but last week against Mississippi State, he threw a couple of interceptions, and it was on passes that he wasn't really being pressured on. And so the talent's there. I don't know if the injuries have slowed the development or what, or maybe they just don't have enough talented wide receivers. I mean, when you look at their group of receivers, it's not that impressive. So they've really just been a team that's really relied on the ground game. They're going to run it a lot more than they're going to throw it. And then on the defensive side, they got some really good players, especially along the defensive line. They got a couple of kids that will likely be a first-round draft, or could be first-round draft picks, I should say. So that will be something that they're going to have to certainly a lot of people are looking at the matchup here between LSU's offensive line, which we know is so good, going up against this Texas A&M defensive line. So that's going to be a lot of fun to see how that all shakes out here, because you got some really good players. Even their head football coach, Mike Elko, called it something like the $10 million matchup, because mm-hmm. you just got first rounders with Will Campbell for LSU and Emory Jones going up against the likes of Nick Scroton and Shamar Stewart for Texas A&M. Torin York is kind of like their Whit Weeks at linebacker. He's been really good as a sophomore. And they got a kid in the defensive secondary that has three interceptions on the year. And so Marcus Ratcliffe. So a lot of people expecting this game kind of to be played in the 20s or so. And it should be a really tight football game throughout.
Le'Veon Moss is their bell cow?
Oh, for sure, for sure. No doubt about it. I mean, he's rushed for 100 yards or more in three of his four SEC games this season. Had a really big game against Missouri. That's really the highlight game for Texas A&M this year. Missouri came into that contest ranked number 9 in the country, and the Aggies, they blew the doors off on the Tigers. They won that game 41-10, but I think as we've seen through the season, I don't really know how good Missouri is. They have not looked all that great, barely got past Auburn this past weekend. But still, that was a game at 11 a.m. A&M was ready for it, and Missouri just they got walloped in that game. They couldn't get off the mat.
First year for Elko, right, head coach?
Yeah, Mike Elko, and there's obviously a connection between him and Brian Kelly. Elko was on Brian Kelly's staff in 2017. He was actually Brian Kelly's defensive coordinator that season. They went 10-3 that year. They beat LSU in the Citrus Bowl. After that, he got the job as the defensive coordinator at Texas A&M. He was there for 4 years, got his first head coaching job in 2022 with Duke. And we all know Duke's not a powerhouse when it comes to playing football, but he was named ACC Coach of the Year in 2022 as the Blue Devils went 9-4 that year. And then the following year, they went 7-5. Obviously, when A&M let go of Jimbo Fisher, they were looking for a head coach. I don't think Mike Elko was their first choice, but there was a level of comfort there in Mike Elko and the fact that he was at Texas A&M before as a defensive coordinator. And they look at him as a 47-year-old guy who's an up-and-comer. And, so far, you can't, other than that first game against Notre Dame, which was just a real dud for them, they've looked really good this season winning their games. I mean, I think they have benefited a little bit playing the lower-tier teams in the Southeastern Conference. I mean, they beat Florida. They beat Mississippi State. Those teams are not all that good. They beat Arkansas, and Arkansas is probably, you can label them, a mediocre team. So they haven't gone up against the best. This is going to be their best foe that they've faced so far in the Southeastern Conference. And I think LSU's been tested a little bit more in the fact that they had to go on the road and play a tough South Carolina team, and then obviously winning that big game at home against Ole Miss.
I was talking about laughing about Notre Dame. I'll tell you who's laughing is Jimbo Fisher. He's still laughing, wherever he is.
He's got a lot of money to laugh with.
Yes, he does. Yeah. 7:21, yeah. More when we come back with Jeff Palermo. Questions, comments about the LSU game. We'll talk about the LSU offense when we come back. Right now, 7:21, traffic, WWO. All right, 7:26 and a half, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Quickly back to Jeff Palermo, WWL.com columnist, Louisiana Network news director. Let's talk about LSU's offense, health of the receivers.
Yeah, good question. Maybe, just maybe, fingers crossed here, Tommy, that we might see Chris Hilton for the first time this season. Brian Kelly told reporters yesterday he was a full go at practice yesterday. He had suffered a leg injury all the way back in preseason camp, and for a while now, he's been listed as basically week-to-week and listed as questionable going into every game. But Brian Kelly really sounded pretty optimistic yesterday that he may play. He talked about the fact that right now it's mainly a conditioning thing that he's trying to work up on that conditioning, being a wide receiver. So it doesn't seem like the pain or the injury itself is holding him back. If he feels good to go out there and I don't know, get to a dozen to 20 snaps tomorrow, I think we'll finally see him. And that's big because he's the one guy that can really stretch the defense. They've been missing that this season. We've talked about it several times so far this year, Tommy, that they've really needed to have a guy that can kind of stretch the field. And he's their speed burner, so they can certainly use him. And then it was great to get C.J. Daniels back last week. He was so instrumental in that game against Arkansas, and everybody else seems to be pretty healthy. So the one piece that they've been kind of missing on offense, they may finally get against Texas A&M.
Do you remember Kyron Lacy getting nicked up a little bit or not from last week?
Well, remember in the Ole Miss game, it looked like he suffered a really bad injury at one point, and the training staff had to come out there and look at him, and then a few plays later, he was back out on the field and, of course, had the winning touchdown catch. So. But it looked bad there when he had kind of an awkward fall to the ground in Lacy, and you were fearing the worst. But somehow he avoided a major injury there, and He's been fine. He's been fine.
You know, we talk about the speed of Caden Durham, but he really does, for a guy that's 5'9", talk about run behind his pads and run with power. Talk about that for a little bit, if you would, Jeff.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he has been, we talked about it at the start. Who would have thought that LSU and Texas A&M would be the marquee matchup of the college football slate on this October Saturday? And who would have thought that a guy like Caden Durham was going to be the main guy for LSU as far as their rushing attack? And he certainly looked a lot more healthy last week. Remember, he had the dislocated toes.
He looked completely different to me. That, to me, looked like a healthy Caden Durham. You?
But this kid's a track star. We believe he's going to be competing on the LSU track team, and he's got the speed, but he does run so low and he runs so powerful that he's able to break tackles. We saw that in the South Carolina game. He's also got some moves to him as well. He can make some people miss. He has been such a huge addition to this team. I don't know really where they would be without him. They probably would have a couple losses if they didn't have Caden Durham.
Tredez Green, 6'7". You know, I like that the arm span on that guy. Man, I'd like to see him go against these Texas A&M corners. Let Garrett Nussmeier throw up one of them balls real high in the air, you know?
Well, we saw a lot of them last week. We'll see if maybe he gets his snap count reduced if Chris Hilton is out there. But I know Brian Kelly and Joan Sloan, the offensive coordinator, they're trying to figure out ways to get him the ball. So I think he will be a part of the offensive attack for the Tigers tomorrow night.
Real quick, we're a minute late. How do you see it playing out?
Man, I see this one being very, very close. I think if home field advantage for Texas A&M is big in this game, LSU's got to avoid those pre-snap penalties that they saw against Arkansas.
Yeah.
But, I got to be honest with you, Tommy. I've been kind of twisting and turning here. I'll have my preview piece up at WWL.com, and I'll have my official prediction there. How about that?
We'll look for it. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate your time. Minute late time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Dave Cohen. It is Friday morning, 7:45, quarter till 8, round these parts. About these times, we help you manage your money with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. If you can, safely, not while you're driving or anything, go to jeffersonfinancial.org. You look in the middle of the page, you see manage your money plan for your future with our financial calculators. You can click on that. It's absolutely free. No data will be stored. Nobody's going to contact you or anything like that. But they got a lot of calculators, some of which Mark's going to refer to here, that might help you out and help you manage your money. And that's what Mark's going to do right now. How you doing, Mark?
Good morning, sir, and happy Friday to you.
Happy Friday to you as well. What are we talking about
Absolutely.
Today? What are we managing?
Tell me that we have had mortgage rates that have risen for the fourth straight week. And many say they're headed towards 7%. I had somebody from the station contact me earlier this week, and they said, you know what, we hit a low point after our conversations. The person in question was looking into rates because they were from out of town. They moved here. They're looking to buy a home, and they hit it just right. They got a 30-year loan, fixed rate for 5%, and it's like that came and went. That's gone. And, you know, Tom, we've had downbeat economic narrative that have been overshadowed by stronger economic data. Because you and I have talked about True Hardware, they just filed for bankruptcy, Walgreens closing stores, CVS is closing stores, Rite Aid is emerging from bankruptcy. They filed last year. The number of layoffs that have come out, the looming commercial loan crisis that I think is just in its infancy. It's going to keep unfolding. And here the Fed knows all those things, if we know those. And it's the employment report came in better than expected. Retail sales seem to come in better than expected. People are getting raises because the companies have to be competitive with keeping up with inflation and so on. So it's like the economy keeps signaling that it's stronger than a lot of the narrative would suggest that it is. So what it's like, who cares? Well, I'm glad the economy's stronger, but what we really need in the economy is to turn around this anomaly where the rates are, where the Fed put them in their effort to fight inflation. And we still have short-term rates that are higher than some of the intermediate-term rates. And it just makes a mess out of financial markets. And we're seeing that unfold. And we're going back to where I started here, that the mortgage rates now have risen for the fourth straight week. So we had a 5.7% rate just last month. And now it's moved to the sixes because the market has moved and Fannie Mae has moved. And that a lot of financial institutions, especially for mortgage stuff, they have to price off of some of the information that comes out of Fannie Mae. And it's, you know, it put the Fed on pause. And we've been talking about this since last year, last October, when Powell came out saying, oh, you know what, next year is the time. It's about time we start lowering rates, because they've certainly raised rates over the past couple of years. So at the beginning of the year, I remember the forecast, we're going to have 11, you know, there was one, it might have been Goldman Sachs, it was one of the main money center banks I thought it was looking at. We're going to have 11 interest rate reductions in 2024 that was supposed to begin in March. I know we've reported on this before, but in case some of our listeners didn't hear that news, and none of that happened. It kept getting kicked down the road. Well, the financial institutions and financial markets were anticipating some of those rate reductions. So, you know, a lot of them, including us at Jefferson Financial, we lowered our rates to match, or to, I guess, be a front runner and provide our members with more better than competitive rates. And when the Fed says, you know what, we're looking at other data that might suggest that we slow down. In fact, one of the Fed governors came out this past week saying, let's not be too hasty. We don't have to lower rates anymore. Well, maybe we need to sit and wait some more and see what other economic data comes out. So they're even in conflict. They, the people that sit on the Federal Reserve Board, the Open Market Committee, the group of people that decide on the direction of rates and the money supply. So they're saying, we just lowered by 50 basis points, 0.5%. And they were supposed to, or at least it was for, when I say that, that's bad language. It was forecasted that they were going to have another 50% rate drop, and then yet another, at least 25 by the end of the year. So I'm looking at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. They have a Fed Watch tool, and the Fed meets in about 13 days. And 95% of the participants there are believing that we'll get a 25 basis point reduction in rates at their next meeting. It's right after the election. And it may all everybody's guesses be right, but this might be dead wrong by the time we get there, depending on what other news comes out. And, of course, the election is going to be right in the midst of all this. So the Fed is supposed to be separate from that. But, you know, it depends on what comes out and political promises and who wins. And they'll be meeting like just a couple of days after that. So where I'm going back to is, if you miss the absolute low that were 5%, if you're waiting for that other basis point, the market is to drop, the market has moved away from you. And another statistic that came out this week, sales of previously owned homes, because of what's going on of late within the past month, the sales, the slowest rate in sales of 14 years. So it's hit the market, and it's hitting the big ticket market, which is housing, and expensive items for long periods of time. Rates 30-year last year were about 7.79, and today they're 6.44. A big difference there. Glad they have fallen that much, but they've risen about a point in the past month since they were in the five. So another study came out, CoreLogic put together some statistics, and for Louisiana, we have one of four states that it's cheaper to buy than rent. So says CoreLogic. And then I wanted to segue over, Tommy, that's a complicated thing that a lot of people would find very difficult to really wade themselves through it. Should I rent or buy? Well, it can be complicated. All the things that go into home ownership versus you feeling like I'm renting from somebody, I'm not building equity. My money is just going to the landlord and I walk out like I came in. I'm not carrying any equity with me, or any plus side on their income statement or on their own balance sheet. So we have, Jefferson Financial has mortgage calculators, and one is rent versus buy. So if you get confused about all the variables that may be involved, that will at least get you through it for those that are interested. Maybe some of us are renting right now. We're seeing where the rates have gone. We've gotten a little bit discouraged by, well, I maybe missed the bottom, but is it still a decent time to do this? I know a friend of mine that's in Florida. That Florida is not one of those four states. Florida is one of the states where it's cheaper to rent because things, their economy is different than ours and is more activity there than it seems to be here. But that would be a place for people to go to help them walk through these big decisions in life.
So if you go to jeffersonfinancial.org, which I just did, and clicked on a tab, you see under, first off, you start at the home page, which is plan for your future with our financial calculators. Then from there, it'll take you to mortgage calculators. Under that, you see rent versus buy. You click on that, and that is a very handy tool where you can plug in your numbers. Again, Mark, you can't break the computer. Nobody's going to call you or anything like that. Absolutely free.
You don't have to log in.
Don't have to log in. No password. None of that stuff.
None of that stuff.
But it is a very valuable tool because that can be terribly confusing as to whether it's cheaper to rent or buy.
It is. And it gets, you know, to buy, people are typically, the common complaint is, well, look, it's not, you need to come to the closing table with money. I need some cash to get there. We will do financing up to 97%. A lot of lenders say, no, we're stopping at 80%. To bring 20% cash of a home price to the table is not what everybody can do. So if some of the lenders will loan more than 80% in the 90s, okay, that helps. So that's part of where, you know, the calculator comes in to say, I don't have to bring as much to the closing, but what will it mean to my payment and how does that compare to the alternative? I'm not going to buy at all. I'm just going to stay renting. And that helps you walk through that, because doing it on your own and you're going to get the napkin out and try to figure it out, I think is going to be more than frustrating.
Yeah, especially
that's
if it's
what you need. You need
especially
a tool.
If it's a cocktail napkin. Thank you, Mark.
Will you see?
Valuable information. We'll talk to you Monday as we take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street. Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. Go to jeffersonfinancial.com.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Org 755. Aye, get ready. Saints battling the Chargers Sunday in L.A. Coverage starts at 11 a.m. live from Rouse's Market in Metairie on Power Boulevard. You can head out and make groceries for your tailgate party. Hang out with Team WWL First Take with Steve Geller and Charlie Long. That's first up. Then at 1 o'clock, Bobby Hebert is going to be at Rouse's for the Bud Light Countdown and Kickoff. Game time with Deuce and Hoss at 3:05. Do yourself a favor. Turn down the sound, turn up Deuce and the home team and Haas and Jeff Nowak on the sideline. Then when it's over, sound off with the Ciroc point after with the Cajun Cannon. Saints Chargers, 10 hours wall-to-wall football Sunday starting at 11 o'clock at Rouse's Market in Metairie on Power Boulevard and here on WWL and live on the free Odyssey app. Mike Dettillier, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you, Tommy.
Let's talk about these. First off, let's talk about the Saints and the injury situation. And the Chargers and the injury situation. What do we know?
Well, the good news is the Saints have gotten back a number of the guys. Full participation, Taysom Hill and Cesar Ruiz. Pete Werner's back at practice. I think there's some. I think he's been limited, but those three in particular certainly play a big part in this. And defense hasn't played the same since Pete Werner's been out, to be honest with you. And on offense, Eric McCoy is a couple weeks away, but to get Taysom back, he's another big cog for him in the running game going up against the Chargers. The only guy that's added to the list was Cedric Wilson Jr., the wide receiver. You sort of thin there to begin with, and he missed yesterday with a hip injury.
Let's talk about the Rattler, Spencer Rattler. What is he going to look face with this Los Angeles Chargers defense, Mike?
Well, like with any young quarterback, I think the biggest thing is, don't try to do too much. And yet, you want him to still be a bold quarterback. So you design plays, and I think for him is best, on the move, kind of cut off one half of the field and throw to a designated spot. That part he has done pretty well. He's really a pocket quarterback. But when you see what he does well in the NFL, A lot of it is when he's moving, kind of waggle plays left to right and throwing off the run. And I think that's what you got to do against the Chargers. But first and foremost, you got to run it. You got to have a semblance of a running game here, that because you know that the Chargers are going to give him some looks like any other young quarterback. I would try to trick him a little bit. But if you got a running game going, that's a young quarterback or even an old quarterback's best friend, the ability to run the football. And if you can have Taysom back along with Alvin Kamara in the backfield, and to be honest, the few touches Kendra Miller got, hey, he's got to also be a big part of this in the running game.
Along those lines, Jim Harbaugh and the Los Angeles Chargers. I got the right Harbaugh, don't I?
Yeah, Jim.
Yeah, I get them confused. They love to run the football, which means they love to keep the defense on the field, which means if you as the Saints can run the football, you keep your defense off the field, keep them off the field. That's true about the Chargers, right, running the ball?
It's true about any coach team with Harbaugh, no matter where he's been. When he was at University of San Diego, at Stanford, when he was with the 49ers, and he was, I mean, he won 69% of his games with the San Francisco 49ers. And then he goes to Michigan, and then now with the L.A. Chargers, it's always going to be about the running game. He feels as though you got to win it up front, be physical with players, and kind of move the chains. And this Charger team doesn't have a great array of outside weapons. Ladd McConkey, who they picked up in the second round from Georgia, has been effective, but you know the list there is not long. He has always emphasized, I want to build my team a certain way, and that is with big offensive linemen and being able to control the clock with the running game. And that's exactly what he's doing. His defense is stingy. They're quick flowing to the football. Maybe he got an outside shot here to do a little damage against those corners. They play off quite a bit, so I think you can take a little bit of an advantage of that. But with Jim, he can coach till he's 90 years old. He ain't never going to change. It's always about running the football.
Let's take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Mike to tell you about the Saints game Sunday against the Chargers. All the action right here on WWL. Right now, 820 traffic on WWL. 825, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Big game for the Saints Sunday against the Chargers. Before that, big game for the Tigers against the Aggies against Texas A&M. WWL coverage starts at 2 o'clock. Join Mike Dettelier and Herb Tyler, former LSU quarterback for Gulf Coast Bank and Trust Tiger Tailgating Show. That's live from Acme Oyster House in Baton Rouge, presented by MAP Construction. Always a great time with Mike and Herb. Great insights from both of them. Acme has 16 surround sound TVs, great drink specials, plus life's more fun with seafood. And catch LSU pregame at 4:30 kickoff with Chris Blair and Jacob Hester. Do yourself a favor. Turn down the sound on a TV. Turn up WWL. Listen to their broadcast of the game of the Tigers and the Aggies. 10 hours of exciting LSU football tomorrow starting at 2 o'clock on WWL and a free Odyssey app with the aforementioned Mike Dettelier and Herb Tyler. Mike, let's talk about the quarterback matchup here. You got Justin Herbert and Spencer Rattler, seemingly advantage Herbert. Thoughts?
Yeah, the experience, the talent. Justin Herbert's got immense skills as a quarterback in what you're looking for. And he's related to Bobby.
Is he?
We went through that when he came to Manning camp. Him and I had a long talk about it because he said there's not a day goes by that people don't bring up the Seinfeld thing about H-E-B,
E-R-T. I was getting ready to say that. You read my mind.
H-E-R-B-E-R-T. Yeah. He said somewhere down the line, one of our relatives got in trouble, and he, he ended up out west in the Pacific Northwest, and Bobby's here. So,
wait, is that a true story or not?
That is a true story.
Got in trouble, ended up in the Pacific Northwest. From there, Justin Herbert spells his name with an R and winds up with the Chargers.
Yeah, that he says that's what he has been told throughout the years by relatives of his.
So, talk about butterfly effect, like, man.
What's that?
Talk about butterfly effect. Man, I'm telling you.
And it's weird how their athletic sort of high school stuff mirrors one another. He played a lot of baseball, was a really good basketball player, similar to Bob. Sort of took up football a little bit later in life, had this big growth spurt. He said when he was in the 10th grade, Bob had it after the 9th grade. It's amazing. It's almost like the carbon copy of one another. Mm-hmm. The only thing Bob had told me, Mike, he ain't as big as me. Oh, yeah, he's bigger than him from a height standpoint. And he's got a really strong arm.
Wait, he's bigger than whom?
No, Herbert's bigger than Bobby.
Okay. Bobby's pretty big.
I don't think he's taller than me. I was like, I don't know. So we took a picture, him and I, mm-hmm. Herbert and I, and I sent it to him. He's like, oh, yeah, he's taller than me. Really good kid.
Yeah, he's 6'6".
He was not highly recruited coming out of high school. Oregon came in sort of late in the process, and he lived, I think he told me, like 5 miles away from Oregon Stadium. He grew up 5 miles away. And yet, you know, he wasn't a widely recruited guy. But, man, he's athletic. He's got all the skills. Now, my thing with them is like any other team, I stop the running game, you beat me. You beat me throwing the ball. Because I can do some things to get some heat on you. But if I can stop that running game, or at least slow it down, I got a fighting chance against the Chargers. If you got a running game going, I know what Jim's going to do. And he's watched the film of the last 2 weeks. He has seen that teams have gashed this front seven. And you can bet your last buck that's what he's going to do. And he's going to at least try. And the Saints have to stop the run. Mm. But Justin Herbert, immensely gifted at the quarterback position.
6'6", 250-something, I think. You better get two hands on that guy, man. I'm going to tell you what. We'll take a break, pick it up here. We're coming back. For those of you, and I'm getting some text here, don't know what the butterfly effect is. In essence, it means that one little bitty thing like a butterfly flapping its wings in one part of the world, a small change in one state of a deterministic nonlinear system can result in a big chaotic change somewhere else. And that's what I meant about somebody in the Hebert family way back in the day getting in trouble. They go to the Pacific Northwest, add an R to the name. As a result, then Justin Herbert grows up by Oregon Stadium, then winds up playing for the Chargers. So all because whoever got in trouble with whomever back in the day. And it's not a bad movie either if you've seen it, The Butterfly Effect. And I'm not an Ashton Kutcher fan, but we're way off the subject. More with Mike Dettelier when we come back. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Dave Cohen. 844, 16 till 9, Mike Dettelier, our guest. WWNFL.com columnist, Louisiana Network News Director, to talk about the Saints. Mike, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but you know how the text line can work sometimes, right?
Yeah.
Somebody texted in and said that there is no relation between Justin Herbert and Bobby Hebert. Despite having similar names and playing positions, they are not related. I only bring that up because you got this from Justin Herbert himself, did you not?
This is what Justin Herbert told me.
Yes, yes. The source, himself.
People... And he got it passed down throughout the generations, so to speak. So, but if they got people that think they know everything about everything.
Yeah, I just find it interesting.
Bob brought it up.
Go ahead.
Bob brought it up even before. He's like, Mike, is Justin Herbert going to be at Manning camp? And I'm like, yeah. He said, ask him. You know, ask him about this, ask him about that, and about the Herbert and Hebert thing. And so, somebody actually called him Justin Hebert, mm-hmm. and he laughed. And then somebody pointed out that's the guy that works with Bobby Hebert. And so I got the interview. I was interviewing him, and he brought it up that he said, "I think somewhere down the line, this is what I've been told." throughout the deal, that's sort of how it was.
The only reason I bring it up is that in this day and age of everybody, and no disrespect to anybody, but of everybody thinking they know everything, this goes back to the source itself, to the quarterback himself. All 6 feet, 6 inches of him told you this, correct?
Told me that.
Okay. All right. So look online, do whatever you want. I'm just telling you, this is what the man
himself. Yeah, well, you know what they do? They go to Wikipedia. Mm. And, oh, I didn't see it there on Wikipedia or whatever. So I get it. And
I'm not trying to get you angry. I just think it goes.
No, it's not.
This is from the source itself, and you're choosing not to believe that, which drives me kind of crazy. Let's talk about.
No, but
go ahead.
We live in that age, Tommy.
Yeah.
We live in, no matter what, they don't want to believe it. They don't want to believe.
Okay,
it.
Okay, I just thought I'd talk about that a little bit. Let's talk about the Saints cornerback situation and Chargers receivers, and how you see this game playing out.
Well, Marshawn's back, and then you're going to have Alante Taylor, but you're going to see a lot more of the rookie, Kool-Aid McKinstry, in the lineup. They haven't lit the world afire throwing the football. Now, again, the Saints' defense has been sort of the elixir to get everybody back healthy over the last couple of weeks. But that's not what they really hang their hat on offensively. They want to run the football with J.K. Dobbins. They got the young rookie from Troy. They give the football to quite a bit also. So you can see this, you know, no question about it. And Kamani Vidal, they just want to control the clock. They are good playing small ball. That is what Harbaugh wants to do. He doesn't care if he beats you 17-16 or 20-17. That's right up his alley. The Saints should have the advantage from a coverage standpoint. They really should at this point. Now, can you get pressure on Justin Herbert is the thing. Because Rashawn Slater is a top 5 or 6 left tackle in this league. He's that good. And come draft time, when Charlie Long and I would do the kind of draft shows, he was like, you almost so sure about Joe Alt going before Malik Nabers. Nothing against Malik Nabers at all. But I knew if he's there and the Chargers come to pick both of them, I knew he was going with Joe Alt, the big tackle from Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. So he got bookend tackles, and they're pretty solid in the middle. And you understand with Harbaugh, they want to run the football. They want to run the ball. So the Saints got the advantage from a coverage standpoint. It's just, can they stop the run?
When it comes to the guy on defense, every defense has their guy, right? Who is the Chargers' guy?
Joey Bosa, Khalil Mack. Mm. And that was a big question mark when Jim took over the team. Would Harbaugh keep both of them, both highly priced veteran players? And he decided that he was going to do it. And I would have too. Man, those two guys. You might say, I got a guy that's pretty close in talent. No, you don't. You don't have a guy close in talent to Khalil Mack and Joey Bosa. Not on that team. They're the straws that turn the drink. They come off the edges. They run to the football quickly. One thing with Joey Bosa, he's pedal to the metal every play. He gives you everything he's got. And he's a really good edge rusher. Khalil Mack, they've used him a lot of different ways. He's not the 24-year-old Khalil Mack. He's got a little bit of age on him, and so he's been nicked up, and again, Father Time catches you. But, man, he is still a good player. Excellent against the run. Not quite the edge rusher of yesteryear, but he's still really good. So those are the two guys. And, again, they sort of control the edges and force you to run in between the tackles where they got some bulky interior defensive line.
All right, let me take a break. We're going to come back. I want to talk about something we talked with Deuce with earlier this week, I think it was, Tim? We talked to Deuce earlier this week. It's been a long week. I think so. Yeah, I think we did. About salary cap issues with the Saints and blowing it up and kicking a can down the road and all of that stuff. So Mike Dettelier, our guest, WWL NFL analyst, co-host of Sports Talk. He'll be part of the pregame coverage on Sunday. He'll definitely be part of the Tigers pregame coverage tomorrow at Acme Oyster House in Baton Rouge starting at 2 o'clock, 8:51, 9 till 9. Traffic now, WWL. All right, 8:56, 4 till 9, back with Mike Dettelier. Mike, we had an interesting conversation with Deuce McAllister earlier this week about, you know, first of all, people were so upset over the Denver game. Somebody swore to me that there was no way Dennis Allen would be the head coach for the Chargers game, and I offered to bet this person $1,000 in cash. But the stipulation was, you got to bring your money. It's like Joe Pesci and my cousin Vinny. No. Bring the money, and we'll have a third party hold it, and then we'll bet. And they, of course, crawfished out of it. But people were all emotional, and you can't, whether you like Dennis Allen or not, you can't run a franchise based on emotional and knee-jerk reactions. So with that being said, Deuce was talking about, you know, blowing the whole thing up and salary cap issues and everything else. Talk about that and the future of the Saints, if you will. And I know injuries have decimated the team this season so far, but you can't, they don't have an option of blowing this thing up, do they?
Not in the middle of the season, you don't. I mean, you sort of all in at this point. And you see what happened with the Jets. Okay, Woody Johnson made the decision. I'm getting rid of the head coach. I'm bringing in Jeff Sowich. I'm going to go out and trade for Davante Adams. He re-signed Hassan Reddick, who they had traded. They brought him in and redid his deal. Okay, he was trying to kind of add to the puzzle. It hasn't worked, even with the additions. He's hitched his wagon to Aaron Rodgers.
Mid-season firings never work.
It's rare. It's a rare occasion that it'll work. And so you have to look at it that you want to be competitive down the line, and you want to try to take care of the veterans that you have, that you think have football life left in them in the future. That's why the draft is so important, because if you hit on draft choices, you're paying them football minimum wage for 3 to 4 years. That's why the Chiefs have been able to win along with Mahomes. They've drafted so well. So the Kamara extension, that didn't surprise me one bit. My thing is, when I get rid of somebody, do I have anybody close to his talent on this team? Just think about it. Do you have anybody close to his talent level?
Not just talent, but leadership ability on the field and off the field. You know what I'm saying? By example?
Yeah, and sometimes you got to make tough decisions. Sometimes you know if that guy's at the end of his career and you don't extend him. You let it play out. He might go on somewhere else to play another year or two. You have to make those tough decisions. But, you know, blowing it up, you don't blow up nothing in the middle of the season. Fire everybody. That I hear that a lot also. Fire everybody. Get rid of everybody. You don't know the dynamics of this team.
Mike, let me tell you.
You don't know how that. That's not going to happen here.
We're about out of time. Give me a prediction, if you will.
I think it's close. I mean, give me that 7.5 points. Tell me, this crazy? They got 3 games, 10 points or more this a week, and 1 game, 9.5. Saints are 7.5. Give me the 7.5. I think this is a really close game.
Hi, my friend. Tigers win? Yes, Cano, quick.
I think Tigers win in a real close one.
All right.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Sinatra, somebody texting and had the Bobby Sockers. It's like back in his day. So it's like, well, no, because at that point, $4,000 would get you a house. Yeah. So I don't think it's a cult. I don't think there's anything like that about it. It's just, you know, it's the it factor, like you've been saying in the news. I don't know what it is, but she's got it. Well, let's see what Michael Glasser's got for us. President of Pano, been on a job, and I try to keep track of this, Captain, 46 years or 47?
I'm in year 48, John.
48. Well, we haven't spoken to you in a while, so there you go. Good morning to you, first of all. How you doing?
Good. How are you this morning?
I'm all right, sir. Let's talk about, you could be working this weekend, I presume, with the Taylor Swift crowd?
Oh, yes. I'll be at the Dome.
You know, I saw some things on social media about, and this is not what you came on for, but about Bourbon Street, the nicest, most polite crowd they've seen. You're not anticipating, I don't think NOPD is anticipating any problems from the fans at all, are they? That's not the Taylor Swift crowd?
No, the only problems we expect from fans is just the fact that there's so many of them and the traffic necessary to get people to and from the Dome. And just the large number of individuals that will be out there. But as far as a problem crowd, no, not at all.
Well, let me tell you, congratulations, 48 years on the job with NOPD. You're to be thanked and celebrated for that. Let's get on to your role as president of Pano and what's going on with Mayor Cantrell. And, Captain, if you will, give us some context on this, because I know the news story is about the promotions, but I think you need to tell us about the underpinnings of this and how it all works.
Well, you know, it's not a very complicated issue, but there are a lot of moving parts to it. The bottom line is the superintendent decided to give a captain's test, and for the first time in 34 years, a major's test. And we were all very happy about that. And
Hang on a second. I'm going to slow you down a little bit, okay, because I want to know this. You've been on a job 48 years. The first time a captain's test in how long?
First time a majors test in 34 years. Last majors test was in October of 1990.
Okay, and what about the captain's test? Does that come up more often? Or
that was about, I think the last one was 3 years ago.
Okay, so why the big delay in the major test? And tell me what the difference is in the ranks in NOPD and how it works and how all of that plays in to, and even the hierarchy, how that plays in the civil service. Because you're a captain, the next step up for you would be major?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. The way it works is the classified services. We have police officer, sergeant, lieutenant, captain, major, and then there are appointed positions of deputy chief and superintendent. Those are what's called unclassified and appointed positions. So within the classified service, it's major. And for a long time, they've allowed the position to atrophy. And as people retired, they never replaced them. They kind of wanted the position to disappear for whatever reason. I think that was a mistake, but that's what they wanted to do. And we had one major left, and as long as there was one left, they couldn't abolish the position. Mm-hmm. And we've been unsuccessful in dealing with most superintendents and trying to get a major's position. Superintendent Riley did it back in 2008. He brought it back briefly, but before he could give a test, he was replaced, and the next superintendent, Sir Paz, decided not to do it. And we had a position of commander, which was another legal battle that we had. And the bottom line is, it's been 34 years, but Superintendent Kirkpatrick decided to resurrect the position and issue a test. And so we had two tests at the same time, a captain's test and a major's test, both done procedurally the same way.
Did you take the major's test?
Yes, I did.
Okay. I'm just wondering, you've been a captain how long?
17 years.
So you've been waiting to be a major, I guess. I don't know how long you'll be a captain before you can take the test, but you've been waiting a long time to take this test, just as a case study, as an example.
That would be correct. In fact, I was one of the provisional majors back in 2008, before the position was again abolished by the superintendent. But we haven't had majors, again, since 1990 was the last promotion.
So there are no majors right now, the last one retired?
No, he's still there. There's one left.
Okay, so it's not abolished. The position hasn't been abolished yet, but they're on the road. That's what you're saying?
Well, they were trying to do that, but now that we've given a test and we can promote from that test, the position is still there, still valid. Our superintendent had said she wanted to promote two more majors for a total of three, and the position would be valid again.
Let me take a step back, Captain, if I can. Just so people understand, in terms of hierarchy of NOPD and job duties, take me from major to captain to lieutenant to sergeant, and I think we all know what a street officer, what a police officer does, but take me through the responsibilities of each and what the duties entail.
Sure. The obviously, the police officer is officer on the street. They are supervised generally by sergeants, which may be both in detectives, maybe in special operations, or just uniform patrol. Sergeants are your first-line supervisors. Your next line are lieutenants, who supervise the sergeants and the police officers, and then captains, who generally run districts or large squads within the Detective Bureau or other places, or things that are consistent or commensurate with a district command. Mm-hmm. And then when we had majors, we only had one now, but when we had majors, they would supervise groups of districts, and captains would report to the majors, or the majors would be assistant bureau chiefs right under a deputy chief.
For people that
and
are
deputy chiefs run all bureaus.
Wait, say, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Take me back to major. What happens above that?
Is a deputy chief, and they run the five bureaus that we have.
And those would be?
That would be the patrol bureau, basically, field operations bureau. That's basically your uniform patrol services, and that encompasses all of them. Then there's basically the detective bureau, our investigative services bureau, which is basically detective bureau. And then we have public integrity. We have what we used to call public accountability, which basically is a compliance bureau, which makes sure that we're following the consent decree. Mm-hmm. And then we have management services, which handles all of the fleet, academy, buildings, all of basically non-enforcement services. So there are five bureaus, each run by a deputy chief.
Got to tell you, I've been living here all my life, and I'm glad I took the time with this because I never did quite understand the hierarchy of NOPD. Now, for people that are listening, don't know about NOPD and say, you know what, that's top-heavy with management, tell me why you think it's important that they have, and then we're going to get to the mayor's actions in a minute, but why it's important that you have this chain of command and why it's important that you have majors and captains, et cetera.
Well, you definitely don't want the span of control for any particular supervisor to be excessive. Basically, what they've decided is approximately 8 is the most you want to supervise one person to be supervising directly, not indirectly, but directly. And that's written into the consent decree so that you don't want a sergeant supervising more than 8 police officers, because then you begin to lose the opportunity to interact and give them direct and effective supervision. And the same thing with lieutenants. You don't want to supervise more than 8 sergeants. Same thing with captains. You don't want to supervise more than generally you have 4 or 5 lieutenants at most. But when you get to deputy chief, the deputy chief is supervising 20 captains, and there's only 5 of them. So to make it a little more a better hierarchy, you put in 3 or 4 majors, in like a major in each bureau, to assist with the supervision. And it just makes sense to do it. If you see it on a pyramid chart, you would see that it kind of makes sense to do that. And we've just lacked that for a while. There was a time we had 6 or 7 majors, but that was when we had 1,600 officers. Hmm. Now we're down to 800-something, so we don't need quite that many.
When you say supervision, and I don't want to get too far in the weeds on this, but is that – I'm just thinking about a regular management structure. Do sergeants review reports that officers write, and then from that point, lieutenants look at the reports, or are they primarily overview sergeants or only get involved if there's a problem? Tell me about the day-to-day operations. I've always been curious about that.
Yeah, the latter would be more accurate. The sergeants generally are hands-on in terms of reviewing paperwork and showing up on scenes and handling the on-the-street and on-the-scene operations, with lieutenants basically overseeing that operation, making sure that things are done. And sometimes the lieutenant will do the same thing, mm-hmm. especially if they're short a sergeant or somebody doesn't show up or calls in sick. Lieutenant may operate pretty much like a sergeant does, but for the most part, their job is to oversee the sergeant and the patrol officers or the detectives if it's the detective squad.
So when you said 800-something now, is there a particular rank that's been affected more than others? Are sergeants leaving, lieutenants leaving, captains, or is it straight
officers? Oh, it's all up and down, all okay. up and down. You know, you can promote as much as you want. I mean, if you want to have 20 captains, you can make 20 captains. And if you want to have 50 lieutenants, you can have 50 lieutenants. And if you want 200 sergeants, you can do that too. But what's ultimately going to suffer in the end is the police officer, because that's where you're drawing from. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, that's where it comes from. That's the entry level. So if you don't have enough in the entry level, you can promote up, but then you're short on the bottom end, and the bottom end is really the most important.
So as a captain, you're a supervisor. Do you still street patrol or not?
Well, the short answer is no, ordinarily. For most captains who are, let's say, a district commander, they're not going to be rolling out answering calls, but they do things and show up at scenes, major scenes, homicides or other major shooting scenes or other events that call for their attention. They will show up on civil disturbances, things like that. Most of the time, they're dealing with the civic groups. They're dealing with the overall management of the district. For somebody like me, for example, I have a number of units that are on the street that are in plain clothes, and some of which are generally undercover, and I will assist from time to time in that because we are shorthanded, so I will assist them from time to time, but that's unusual.
All right, let me take a break. An interesting glimpse inside the NOPD. We'll come back. We're talking to Captain Michael Glasser, 48 years on the job, about now what Mayor LaToya Cantrell has done about promoting people to major in, I guess, dispute with what the superintendent of the department, Ann Kirkpatrick, wants to do and how that happened or why. Back in a flash, you got any questions, comments, 504-260-1870. Tommy Tucker, Friday morning, WWL. 931, talking to Captain Michael Glaser, our friend. He's been on a job for 48 years with NOPD. He recently took the test to be a major, as did some others. First time major test been given in 34 years, Superintendent Ann Kirkpatrick. And by the way, I presume, Captain, the rank and file, for the most part, happy with the superintendent? Not everybody's going to like everybody, of course, but generally speaking?
Yes, absolutely. Generally speaking, I think the attitude is very, very positive.
I think the city feels that way, too, and I think UNO did a poll that shows that. So let's talk about what happened here. So the major test is given. You and others take it. Then what happens from there for procedurally, and then what happened practically?
Well, basically, to make it real simple and keep it aerodynamic on this, mm-hmm. The test has two parts. There's an assessment part that was handled by an outside company, and that's 50% of the grade done by civil service. Mm-hmm. And then there is an evaluation part of the candidate's job history, resume, disciplinary record, writing samples, yearly evaluations, things like that, that looks at the specific candidate in the background. That's done by a panel of three chiefs, and then the two grades are put together 50-50.
Wait, panel of three?
Up with a single list.
Panel of three what, Michael?
Deputy chiefs.
Deputy chiefs, okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
So,
all right, so what happened here?
Test is structured. That's the way the test is structured, and we did a captain's test along with a major's test. Mm-hmm. Procedurally, they're identical. Obviously, the questions being asked are going to be slightly different because it's a different rank,
right.
But the procedure is exactly the same.
So what happened in this case?
Well, eventually, the list came out from civil service, and then everybody submitted their packets for the deputy chief's review. That grade was issued, and the two grades combined to come up with a final list. And those lists were published. The captain's list and the major's list were published. And then, a short time later, about 10 days to 2 weeks, the exact day I don't recall, mm-hmm. but about 10 days later, superintendent held a meeting and said, there's a problem with the second half of the test, and I can't promote using that second half because there's problems with it. And I can't promote directly from the civil service half because the CAO policy that governs how these tests are to be given requires me to use both halves. And if I can't use both halves, I have no option but to just allow the list to expire without making promotions. It's good for a year, so we'll just let it expire with no promotions to either list, and we'll see you next year.
So why couldn't you use the evaluation part?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. That was our question, is what was wrong with it?
Mm-hmm.
And at first we were told that there were complaints made about the administration of it and how it was done and how it was evaluated. But we never were told who made the complaints and what were the complaints. What was wrong with it? Why was it good for 10 days or 2 weeks, and then suddenly it got bad. Mm-hmm. And then we were told, well, it was the mayor's office who received the complaints, and the mayor decided that we were not going to promote from this list, and the superintendent works for the mayor, so the superintendent was compelled to say we're not going to promote. And to this day, we don't know what the problem was with the second half of that test and why it was problematic. I mean, the city created this test, they administered the test, they graded the test, and then they said, nah, it's no good anymore. How did that happen?
Is that strictly the mayor's call to say at that point? I don't know how the whole rule system is set up.
Well, it's not really supposed to be. You know, that's the thing, and that's part of what the problem is with this, is our system is embedded in the Louisiana Constitution, and civil service actually provides the department with an eligibility roster from which the department is supposed to promote. The purpose of civil service is to eliminate political issues. So while the superintendent is subordinate to the mayor, really not supposed to interfere with that. That's really not the way that's supposed to work. And having a CAO policy that guides civil service is kind of the cart before the horse. It's not supposed to work that way. So that being said, the Black Organization of Police and the Police Association of New Orleans got together and filed a petition with civil service asking them to investigate how this test was done, whether it was constitutional, whether it was consistent with what civil service is supposed to be doing as the Constitution dictates, and find out what happened, because we can't seem to find out what exactly the problem was. It appears that the mayor just didn't like the outcome, and being unable to avoid promoting from it, just decided not to.
So do you know of anybody that complained about the process of how either the deputy chiefs that were involved or the process involved with the evaluations themselves? Have you gotten any word from anybody that was involved in a process at all of complaining about it or not involved?
Well, no. You know, we, meaning Pano, met with the BOP and the FOP, the Fraternal Order of Police, and all three organizations represent virtually 99% of the police department. And we discussed some issues, but we asked to meet with the superintendent. She was unavailable for personal reasons for a while. And then before we had a chance to meet with her and discuss any problems or if there were any problems, this came up where she announced there'd be no promotions. So we, as representatives of the department, we certainly didn't complain about it. And that doesn't prevent individual officers or other people from making complaints if that was the case. But usually when people make complaints, we investigate it. We see if there's any merit to it. We don't just, oh, somebody complains and we scrap the test. It doesn't work that way. The city spent over $100,000 with these two tests. Why would you scrap it based on an alleged complaints? Wouldn't you investigate and see if the complaints had merit and see if there was some way of, if there was and had legitimacy, that perhaps we can fix it? But that wasn't what happened.
Let me read a quote from Rafael Goyeneche here, Metropolitan Crime Commissioner, from a NOLA.com article by Missy Wilkinson, very talented reporter. Rafael says, the information we received was that the mayor interceded and thwarted the chief to not move forward with captains and majors, but was okay with allowing sergeant and lieutenant promotions. What that suggests is the mayor doesn't like the people most likely to be promoted based on their scores. When it comes to sergeants and lieutenants, is it the same 50-50 assessment and evaluation thing, Captain?
It's slightly different because they're not upper-level management, so the test structure itself is similar but not identical. And those tests were not given at the same time with the exact same procedure. You know, we don't use the exact same procedure all the time. Mm-hmm. Those tests evolve as department policies change, as laws change, as public mores change. We test slightly differently as we go along, and hopefully we improve the process as we do. So those tests were given last year and the year before, so they're going to be slightly different, but very similar.
Captain, I don't know if you want to get involved here, but let's cut the crap. This seems to me like the mayor saw the list and said, oh, hell no, absolutely not. After what I hear Jordan Fiegel tells me Rafael Goyeneche is going to be on with Newell Norman later on at 10 o'clock. But it seems to me like the mayor saw the list, said, oh, hell no. I don't know if it goes back to the Vapi investigation. I don't know if it goes back to I don't know what, but it does seem as though that's what happened here. Do you want to weigh in or not?
Well, the thing I can tell you for certain is that we still don't know what was wrong with the second half of this test. The city did it. It was their test. It was their evaluation. And for a period of time, it was fine. And then suddenly it wasn't. And nothing changed except the mayor's review of the test. And while we don't know what was wrong with it, nobody made any effort to tell us or find out what was wrong with it. The only thing we're left with is that the mayor decided not to promote from it, and the superintendent confirmed that he was told not to. So why did the mayor do that? That's the big question, and that I can't speculate on. You know, we can only assume she didn't like the outcome.
So what's your next
thing we can assume, and that's our assumption on it.
So what's your next step? This is supposed to be civil service. It's supposed to be, you know, you take the test, the top scorers are recommended for promotion. Correct me if I'm wrong. That's the way it works?
That's the way it's supposed to work.
All right. So what right of appeal do you have, or what does civil service say about all of this? Because you talked about it
being
in the Constitution.
Well, that's the whole point. Tommy, we just filed 2 days ago, we just filed a petition with civil service asking for them to conduct an evidentiary hearing and an investigation into the promotional practice that we are currently using. Okay, and I'll add one more little thing to this. We were operating that bifurcated system that I described to you, where we do an assessment on one half and then an evaluation of the candidate's background on the other half, was consistent with a CAO policy established in 2021. Well, oddly enough, that policy was in place when we did these two tests, but 2 days after the list was released, that policy was rescinded. And I don't know why that is either. Okay. Now, we had some questions as to whether or not that was constitutionally correct, but why was it rescinded 2 days after the test? Why not 2 days before the test?
Let me ask it a different way.
That would solve some problems. So we're asking civil service to conduct an evidentiary hearing and an investigation to determine whether or not the procedures that we are using and have been used are constitutional and consistent with the law.
Real quick, how's morale under Ann Kirkpatrick, the new superintendent, generally speaking?
Generally speaking, it's very high.
All right. Thank you, Captain. Appreciate your time. Hope you come back as we talk more about this. So basically, I know we got to go, but Ann Kirkpatrick comes in. The city loves her. NOPD loves her. She institutes a captain and a major's test. Everything's going fine until LaToya gets a hold of it, and then the whole thing goes to hell. And the first thing this woman's got to understand, LaToya, is that when you're in a hole, stop digging. 942, 18 till 10, traffic now, WWL. You hear that? You know what those are? Those are fire engines. You know why? Because JR is on fire with taking Vegas and his free picks. How you doing, JR?
I'm doing outstanding, Tommy. Happy Football Friday to everybody down there in Louisiana. Guys, it is time to make some money. I'm going to tell you right now, this is going down as one of my top plays of the week. We've got LSU taking on Texas A&M. Usually it's just a marketing game that
I've
got to
throw out. Hang on, another one's going by, JR. Another one's going by, another fire truck. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Look out.
Yeah.
Stop, drop, and roll.
Go ahead. You're on fire with your picks. Tell me about Texas A&M and LSU.
Again, this is not just one of those marketing picks. We absolutely love the game. We're using it at a very high level for all of our clientele. So I'm going to give it out free right now to everybody in Louisiana. Guys, all you got to do is text the word WIN to 545454. Get the winner of LSU Texas A&M absolutely free via text message. Again, text the word WIN to 545454. And on top of this winner between LSU and A&M, guys, I've got my college football game of the year going down this weekend. And by texting the word WIN to 545454, you'll get the LSU-Texas A&M game absolutely free via text message, and you'll have also an opportunity for the bonus game, our college football game of the year. All you got to do, text the word WIN to 545454, and let's make you some money this weekend.
JR, this is not about, you know, we talk about this every week. This is not about, you know, your team colors, your heart. The color is green, as in money. It's all about information. It's all about math. It's all about the way the book is balanced. What people get from you is information and insider information that they will not get from anybody else. Is that inaccurate at all?
I will take one word out of that, insider information. Okay. Really what we do, we don't need inside information. We've got such a great crew of people, and we know how to break it down. We've got guys that have access, that's what I would call it,
okay,
that give us a little bit more of an edge, right? We're looking to tip the scales in our direction, but we don't do anything we're not supposed to do. We've got
no, I didn't
a
mean
phenomenal
imply that.
Crew. I mean, that's okay. Okay. Listen, that's okay. Got guys all the time, they'll call up and they'll say things like, oh, you guys got the inside scoop. No, we don't need to have inside information to win. I mean, I just went over yesterday with one of my biggest clients, hitting 76% with me so far this year. And he even said to me, he's like, I never thought anything like this was even possible. This guy's betting $50,000 a game. So, I mean, look, if you guys are serious about making money, or at least if you're tired of losing and donating to the sports book and you really want a chance to win, and you can, you know, treat this like a business. And that doesn't mean open up and put all your life savings into it, because I say this all the time. It's still gambling. You're still betting on games at the end of the day. We're going to lose games. We're not going to hit 100%. So if you want to do it right, take whatever bit of bankroll you were going to play around with and entertain yourself with this year, consolidate it, let us know what you're working with, and we'll map out a game plan depending on the amount that you're working with that makes sense, customized to your situation so that you can see the growth firsthand. We're not going to double up on every game. That's stupidity. You got to do things right. We have strategies in place for every bankroll imaginable, and we're able, you know, we're literally going to do this just one game at a time. It's not going to be, hey, you got a $2,000 or $5,000 bankroll, we're tripling it this weekend. It's not like that. We're going to make decisions based on groups of games at a time. We make increases based on how much we're winning, and sometimes you got to pull back if a game don't go your way. So again, text the word WIN to 545454. Get this winner between LSU and A&M absolutely free. Again, free right now via text message, LSU against A&M. All you got to do is text the word WIN, guys, to 545454.
How many times have we heard the difference between winning and losing in the NFL is razor thin? It goes to knowledge and preparation and strategy, and that's what you're talking about with Taking Vegas, right?
No question about it. I can't tell you, by the way, Tommy, how many great clientele, I get from, from Louisiana who have that mindset. Who, you know, hey, listen, I haven't been betting very long, but I see that, you know, you're winning nonstop, and I like the way you're talking about, you know, treating this more like a business and having some strategy rather than just shooting from the hip. I mean, let's face it, college football, college basketball, the NIL, everyone's a free agent. It's nearly impossible to keep up with the sport unless you have experts on your side that actually know what they're doing. So, I mean, this is what we do, right? I've got the best crew in the business. I'm not just some quarterback who just won a game getting interviewed. I'm being truthful. I've got the best guys in the business. I am as successful as I am, and I win like I do because of the people that I've got on my staff. We've had so many years to find the right guys and put them in place, and I don't work at all. I love what I do. I make people money, hand over fist. We're 8-0 on air. If I'm 8-0 on air, what do you think we're doing behind the scenes? I mean, we are absolutely crushing the sports books, and they don't mind paying us because they're making so much money off the public right now. The public's been getting destroyed this year. This past weekend, best weekend that the public's had this year. A lot of the very obvious games wound up coming in, which is, you know, that's not good for the sports books. But week after week, it's been surprise after surprise. Look at last night. You think anybody bet the LA Rams to beat the Minnesota Vikings after the Vikings were undefeated until last week? So, you know, sports books are cleaning up, Tommy, plain and simple.
All right, 8-0 on the free picks. I was kidding you last week saying with your free picks, I'm going to build a lake house and I'm going to invite you over. You got a free pick this week?
Of course. We're going to do it again once more for everyone listening. This is going to make us 9-0 because this is, man, this is about as easy as it gets. Buffalo Bills are on the road taking on the Seahawks in Seattle. Two very high-powered offenses. Buffalo now, you know, with the addition of Cooper, the fact that they've been slinging the rock and they have a real run game this year, Josh Allen not making any mistakes throwing the football like he has years past. This Seattle team has thrown the football over 300 times already this year, number one in the league for slinging the rock. This is going to be way over the posted total. The total on this matchup right now, 46.5. My estimation is it will be 47.5 to 48 by the time we get to kickoff. So go over 46.5 now on the Bills-Seahawks game. That's going to get us to 9-0.
Take us out, JR.
Guys, it's about making money. All you got to do, text the word WIN to 545454. Get the winner of LSU Texas A&M absolutely free via text message. Plus the bonus game, guys. We're going to give you a shot to be able to get our college football game of the year as well. Text the word WIN to 545454. Again, I don't like it. I love this matchup. LSU A&M free via text message. Text WIN to 545454.
See you at the
As always, guys, be safe. Tommy, have fun and go out there and make some money.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events. Major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories. The unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.